This week on Making Contact.
The elephant in the room has awakened, and we're no longer going to be held down by these idiotic preconceived notions of how weak we are, when we know in reality that the workers are the ones that make the world move.
2012 has been declared the year of the co-op by the United Nations.
And the global economic situation is causing more people to consider how worker-owned businesses might serve their employees and the community better.
Intercooperation at this moment is the key to survive. We pass money, we pass people, we are doing projects together.
On this edition, we go from Chicago, where workers are trying to take over the factory to save their jobs,
to the Basque country in Spain, where an entire region has formed a massive cooperative society. I'm George Lavender.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Drastic measures. Laid off workers hold up inside the business that fired them, refusing to leave until the company pays up.
A sit-in at a closed Chicago factory has entered a fifth day as laid off union workers refuse to leave until the plant's reopened or they receive severance pay and accrued vacation time.
Republic is a manufacturer that shuttered its factory on Friday after Bank of America elected not to extend a loan to keep the company going.
Back in December of 2008, the nation's eyes were on Chicago. The Republic Windows and Doors Company announced it would be closing its factory because Bank of America refused to extend a necessary loan. Facing the loss of their jobs, 200 workers occupied the building and refused to leave.
Lalo's been working at Republic Windows and Doors for 34 years. He's the most senior employee here, and he's going to say a few words. Lalo.
Now, I don't think it's fair, you know, to the company do that, you know, just close, you know, from one moment to another one and kick all the employees out on the street. I think, you know, Bank of America, you know, have a lot to do, you know, with this problem that we have over here right now. So Bank of America is one of the banks, you know, that they receive billions of dollars from the government. And nothing for the workers.
Members of the United Electrical Workers Union occupied the factory in shifts, while outside in the snow, other trade unionists showed their support.
These workers have shown the whole working class what to do. We say, Bank of America, you got bailed out, we got sold out. You got bailed out,
we got sold out. You got-
6 days into the sit-in, Bank of America agreed to extend the loan to the company. After a unanimous vote to end the occupation, the workers left the factory through the front doors and declared victory.
Yes, we did! Yes, we did!
As you may know, back in 2008, we was not the only plant that closed abruptly like that. There were many plant closures in Chicago, all over the country. But what made us unique was our decision to fight back.
Ricky Macklin is vice president of UE Local 10. At the union's headquarters in Chicago, he looked back on the successful occupation.
We were fighting a big boss who was a multimillionaire, as well as Bank of America and Chase Bank. So, you know, these are giants, and we were like grasshoppers to them, you know. And we won. We won because we fought.
But that wasn't the end of it for the workers. After the occupation, Republic sold the business to a California-based company, Sirius Materials. And in February 2012, that company announced it planned to close the factory down. Once again, the workers decided to occupy the factory, demanding it be kept open for 90 days, to allow time for another company to buy the business. This time, after just 9 hours, the managers agreed. But after 90 days, no one had come forward to buy the factory. So, the workers decided to try and run the business themselves.
We have a saying that Republic walked away from our jobs and Sirius walked away from our jobs, but we didn't walk away from our jobs. And now moving forward, we workers, we now, as being owners, now we have a direct say in the direction that we want to move.
When we start occupying and the second time, I start talking with the people about if nobody bought the company, probably we could create a cooperative.
Armando Robles is president of the United Electrical Workers Local Union.
And the idea to have the cooperatives is more like conserve our jobs, and creating jobs and help the community.
To that end, Dennis Kelleher has been running classes with a group of workers from the factory to learn how to run a cooperative business.
We are, in some respects, breaking new ground here, particularly in Chicago. We're breaking new ground because we don't have a worker cooperative this size and manufacturing.
Kelleher is executive director of the Center for Workplace Democracy.
One of the skills that for many people is relatively new is cooperative skills, skills that get us used to working in groups, get us used to discussing issues, being transparent in how we operate, and working on developing a very democratic workplace.
Setting up the new cooperative has not been easy. After the occupation of the factory, Sirius Materials agreed to sell the equipment to the workers if they could come up with the cash. An even bigger obstacle, says Macklin, has been the perception that the workers couldn't run the business.
We're taught that, oh, you can't do this, that you're inferior to doing this, that you need us to do this. And that's just not so. I mean, in most of your jobs, they run just great without bosses and supervisors.
New Era Windows would be just that, a new era for worker-owned businesses. After the first factory occupation, Ricky Macklin took part in a victory tour of the country, giving talks in different towns and cities, encouraging other workers to take similar action. Now he says he wants others to follow the Chicago workers in taking control of their workplaces.
May I tell you a quick story right quick? This is one that I used to tell during our victory tour. I remember years ago when I was a small child, I went to the circus. And at the circus, from where I was sitting at, I seen this humongous elephant. Elephants are truly some big creatures. And I looked down and this huge elephant was being held in place by this small ring and chain to one leg. And I'm looking at this small chain and peg holding this huge elephant. And I asked one of the elephant trainers, how is that little chain holding that big elephant? And he explained to me, he said, when the elephants are young, they put the chain on the elephant and the elephant tries to move. And at this time, the elephant is small, so he really can't move. And as the elephant grows, he reaches a point where he doesn't even try to move the peg anymore because he remembers when he couldn't move it. And now here this elephant is able to move buildings, but will not try to move this peg. And I looked at that now as an adult. The workers, we are this huge elephant, and we're being held down because we were told that we could never win, that we couldn't move, that we were powerless. And the elephant in the room has awakened. And we're no longer going to be held down by these idiotic preconceived notions of how weak we are, when we know in reality that the workers are the ones that make the world move.
As we just heard in Chicago, one of the most challenging parts of forming a worker-owned business is that there aren't a lot of models to follow. In some parts of the U.S., there are no co-ops at all. Learning how to manage and run a successful business is not easy, especially when you're trying to do it differently. So many of those co-ops that do exist feel a special responsibility to support each other and help grow the number of worker-controlled businesses out there. One of the model co-op organizations is located in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's called Arizmendi. It started as a cheese shop back in the 1970s and now includes 5 bakeries as well. The newest is in San Rafael, a city just north of San Francisco.
Arizmendi Bakery, 4th Street in San Rafael. This is our bakery. This is our shop. Everything came out this morning. Right now we're working on building some pizzas. We come out by 11:30.
What's on this pizza here?
Red onions, Roma tomato, mozzarella cheese, feta cheese, and we'll put some garlic oil and fresh chopped herbs on top after we're done baking it.
And how many, this is a Monday, how many of these you go through on a Monday?
varies. I think we made about 38 today.
Pizza is the signature dish for all of Arizmendi's bakeries. At one branch, the line for a slice often stretches down the block. But their baked goods aren't too shabby either. Franz van der Groen gives me a guided tour of the numerous offerings on display.
Let's see, we've got some pecan rolls, cinnamon rolls, let's see, a whole bunch of assortments of cookies on the bottom, plain sourdough, wheat sourdough, Asiago sourdough, got some buttermilk bread.
Franz has been working here for a year and a half, and he's been co-owner of the bakery for a year. When someone is hired at this cooperative business, they're considered a candidate for the first 6 months. At the end of the trial period, the rest of the owners vote on whether to approve that person to be an owner, too.
Corn blueberry muffin, got a couple gluten-free muffins.
In the back of the bakery, Sampat Wirasingha is making brioche dough.
I've been here about 6 months now.
Okay, so are you still in the trial period candidate? Or?
No, he's our newest owner.
Yeah, I just became a member.
When?
One day ago.
Nice, congratulations.
Thank you very much, thank you.
How does it feel?
It feels wonderful. That's the best thing can happen.
How come?
Because it's the best job I found so far. I have my freedom and there is no bosses around, so we all put 100% to do our job, right? And you have freedom to do your mind and soul and everything, you know?
It's an interesting blend of both freedom and responsibility. I mean, this place can do as well or as poorly as we want it to. There's not really any limit, which is great in the positive side, but also kind of scary on the dangerous side.
And those responsibilities did get pretty scary. This bakery is only about 2 years old, and like many small businesses, it got off to a rocky start. But Arizmendi shops have a support system to call on, each other. The other four bakeries are all within a half hour's drive from here. So while the parent organization provided bookkeeping and payroll services, members from the other bakeries came and helped with meetings, bringing with them ideas about how to make a cooperative structure function. They also came and worked shifts at the bakery when this one was understaffed. One of them was John Kusakabe.
I feel like what I brought to the table was just an understanding that, you know, this is a new business. You're going to have to make some sacrifices. You're going to have to really compromise on a lot of things in order for this business to succeed.
Kusakabe has been a worker and owner at the Arizmendi Bakery in Oakland for the past 15 years.
Various co-ops have different structures. Ours is pretty much a direct democracy model. Pretty much one vote, one person. It's based on modified consensus, which basically means everything from the price of what a scone costs to if we're going to buy a new oven or if we're going to, you know, allow someone to, say, take an exception to our vacation policy, comes to a general meeting. We meet once a month. In the worst case scenario, if someone says no, you can override it. But in general, I think we strive to come to some kind of compromise in most situations.
It's like a co-op helping out another co-op, which is very cool.
Franz says thanks to Kusakabe and others who came and helped, the San Rafael Bakery is now on firmer footing. But it hasn't been easy.
It took a long time to get our numbers back up, too, because we're not employing just workers. So it was a lot harder in the hiring process trying to find people who didn't just want a job where they could just come in, do 8 hours of work, get a paycheck, and leave. We need people who can invest some serious time and effort in this place, which is a little bit hard to find.
It's not just time which new owners are expected to invest at Arizmendi. There's a $250 buy-in as well, which means every owner has a stake in the organization's success.
I don't feel like I'm expendable, you know, I'm just another cog in the machine, kind of.
As she scrapes off the pizza pans, Paula explains how working in Arizmendi is different from the pizza shop in Texas where she used to work.
If you're the type of person who wants to take responsibility for your work experience, you want to have a decision in how the business is run, then a co-op would probably be good for you. If you're the type of person, you just want to get paid the most amount of money for the least amount of responsibility, it's probably not for you. I like feeling like I'm in control of things, like I'm kind of in control of my destiny.
That sense of control is what all of the owners and candidates here at Arizmendi say is key to why they love working here. Some have worked at co-ops before, others just came in because they saw a help wanted ad.
Order up for Tay.
Sarah Wells was voted in as an owner yesterday after 6 months on the job.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't like their jobs as much as we do. Yeah, a lot of my friends just graduated from college last year, and we've all had jobs, but these are our first real full-time jobs. And it's been really difficult for a lot of people to... Yeah, of course. To find something that makes them happy.
And unlike many jobs, says Kusakabe, the collective structure allows workers to develop their skills.
When we first started, I did a bunch of the bookkeeping. I've done like ordering. I've managed to do some of the menu planning for our pizzas. My shift today was a pizza shift, but during the course of the day, I might be sort of called upon to do other things like ring in customers, you know, put away an order, you know, stock the shelves for the breads and the pastries.
Kusakabe brought all of those skills when he came to help the San Rafael Bakery build a solid foundation. The reward was what he and the rest of the co-op achieved together.
It just showed that even in this sort of hard economic times, a business can make decisions that are not purely based on like the profit motive, because we actually put money into a situation that may not come back to us. And I think, you know, these are people who are really trying to like do something different as far as an economic model, as far as the way they run their business, you know. And I think it really, it makes me proud, actually, that group of people got together and really stepped up and helped.
Tim Hewitt, who helped found the Arizmendi Association of Cooperatives back in 1995, says he believes cooperative development is the most important social change work there is.
I was really good at convincing people that the whole system was going to come to, you know, crashing down and take us down with it if we didn't change it. And got good at depressing people, but not have any answer for them when they said, well, that's fine, but what can you offer better? And I started looking for answers. I also came to the conclusion that if you have a democratic movement, it needs to have a democratic structure underneath it. Otherwise, people just get absorbed into the existing economy. There's other work that has to be done, anti-oppression work. There's other kinds of work that have to be done in concert with that. But if you try to do those kinds of work without an economic base, you don't really change the cause of the problem in the first place.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, California's Arizmendi Bakery got its name in Spain. We go there to find out how and why.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
Hemmed in by mountains and hills, the town of Mondragon in the Spanish region of the Basque Country might not be the most logical base for a corporate giant, yet factories, businesses, research centers, and colleges belonging to the Mondragon Corporation seem to have filled every valley and village in the area, spreading out like fingers. Their activities include everything from banking to bike factories, nanotechnology to rabbit farming. It's a corporate dream, but this corporation is owned by the workers. And as Tom Allen reports, over the past 50 years, Mondragon's success has become an inspiration for co-ops all over the world.
Now we are in the assembly line. Here you can see this is one group. There are 9 people. They have to produce 350 washing machines per day.
Miquel Lesamith is the director of cooperative dissemination for Mondragon. It's his job to explain to the wider world how Mondragon works. Today he's showing a couple from the United States around a Fagor factory. It makes washing machines. He's proud of the factory. He helped reorganize the workers into small, highly autonomous teams.
The system is the self-managed teamwork system. Each group has to manage themselves. Also, they have to repair the lines. They have to do the quality control, and also they have to organize themselves.
If Miquel's trying to impress us, he's picked an odd example. Although the Mondragon Corporation has done well during the recent economic crisis in Spain, this Fagor washing machine plant is actually losing money. The crash in the Spanish construction industry has meant the demand for washing machines has slumped.
3 years ago, they were having profits, but They produce for the new houses, and before producing 4,000 washing machines, it was profitable, but producing only 2,000 is not profitable.
But despite the downturn, Fagon has avoided job losses. They've done this by moving workers into other co-ops that are doing better, and by voting to cut everyone's salaries by 7%. Maria Jesus works in a production team putting together washing machines, but she's also a worker member, or socio, of the company.
We have reduced our salaries so that we can do better. We all earn a little less to give a small boost to the company.
And was it a decision of everyone?
Yes, the majority came out in favor, of course. It was a vote.
Worker members in Mondragon have a lot of power. They elect the governing council for their company, which has the power to hire and fire managers and to set executive salaries. But socios also have more responsibilities and take a share of the risks. When they become members, they have to invest their own money in the cooperative. They also attend regular meetings to discuss important issues. The decision to cut wages at Fagor was the result of 9 months of discussions.
Long, yes, man, there was a fight. It went on for months. In theory, we are meant to have one meeting per month in order to know how things are going, how the sales are going. It's called the collaborators' meeting.
Socios at Fagor are more willing to tighten their belts because they're well informed and because the pain is shared. The 7% pay cut will apply to everyone, from the chief executive to the production worker. In return, Fagor will see up to half its losses covered by a Mondragon Solidarity Fund, which all the co-ops contribute to. In fact, 90% of profits are reinvested in job creation, in setting up new co-ops, in education and social projects, and in the Solidarity Fund.
We believe that intercooperation at this moment is the key to survive. We pass money, we pass people, we innovate together, we are doing projects together, 2, 3, 4 cooperatives to create new projects all over the world, and the intercooperation is the key at this moment.
In the sense of the network, it is unique.
Fred Freundlich is a professor and researcher at the Faculty of Business at the University of Mondragon.
There are many, many employee-owned companies around the world, but not very many of them, almost none of them, are part of a network with other employee-owned companies where they have created institutions they need in common and where they help each other out.
Freundlich believes that the most important institution they created was their own bank, Caja Laboral.
In the late 50s, the first co-ops were getting off the ground, but they decided that it would be hard to convince conventional finance organizations around here to lend the money. So they thought it would be useful for them to have their own financing source, their own bank. Not a credit union in the traditional sense, that's where the depositors are the members, but rather the members are the workers in the bank and the other co-ops in the group. So they created this institution in common, a bank, and then they did it again with Social Security and insurance, and they did it again with research and development, and they did it again with the university, and they've done it now in lots of different kinds of organizations, venture capital fund also, foundation. All of the institutions that they needed, that no one or two or three of them would have been able to create on their own, and for whom it would have been very hard to get these kinds of services in the conventional market. But joining together and creating them together gave them, you know, enough of a critical mass of resources and people that they could create them and make good use of them.
But why did it happen here? Why this extraordinary explosion of cooperatives in this mountainous region of northern Spain? The most important factor was the vision and influence of a Catholic priest, Father José Arizmendiarreta. Posted to Mondragon a few years after the end of the Spanish Civil War, he found a deprived and divided community. Miquel Ledamith.
Father Arizmendiarreta takes the ideas from the Catholic Church, but Father Arizmendiarreta went a step more. He not only tried to humanize the enterprise and develop the community, but he had the idea that the people who work, the labor, has to have the power, and the capital is only a tool.
Arizmendiarreta was a catalyst.
Ainara Udoondo is director of the Lanky Institute, whose work is focused on analysing, maintaining and strengthening the cooperative principles of Mondragon. She says that Arith Mendiareta found fertile ground for his ideas in the Basque Country.
We say trabajo asociado, a work together and to work in cooperation. There's a way of doing things here. You can see it not only in the cooperatives, also in different social movements and things that happen here in the Basque Country.
Arith Mendiareta set up a technical college, but his teachings were as much about the philosophical as the practical, about social justice, democracy and worker ownership. It was a slow process.
When Arismendiarreta came to Arrasate, the first thing that he did was to train people. And there were 15 years of training before the first cooperative was started.
Eventually, he persuaded five of his former students to quit their jobs in a local factory and set up the first cooperative, the company that would later become Fagor. But Arismendiarreta persuaded them to go much further. Fred Freundlich.
His immediate followers, the founders of the first co-ops who had studied in his technical school, he persuaded them to create the bank. They had started the first co-op, and there were a couple of other co-ops getting started, but no one had the idea of formal collaboration to create an institution in common or to work co-op A with co-op B to solve some particular problem or take advantage of some specific opportunity. I think that's the main answer to why it happened here. This particular person's great insight.
Even Arith Mendiareta could not have foreseen Mondragon's spectacular growth and globalization. The end of the dictatorship in the 1970s and Spain's entry into the EU a decade later brought international opportunities, but also competition from foreign multinationals. The decision was taken to forge the network of co-ops into a corporation, allowing it to respond to challenges and expand more quickly. In the last 20 years, its workforce has nearly quadrupled, and it now has factories in 18 different countries around the world. But some fear that the cooperative principles of Mondragon were weakened during its rapid expansion. In fact, at present, only a third of Mondragon's workers are true cooperative members. There are plans to convert the large number of non-member workers in Spain, but creating co-ops at factories in countries like China, Brazil, and Mexico has proved more difficult.
Is it possible that it will end up on a trajectory where it looks more and more like a conventional conglomerate? It's possible. I think the other scenario is more likely. There are so many thousands of people here in the Basque Country where these co-ops were created and where they're nurtured that are committed to these ideas. I think the co-op trajectory is more likely. Mondragon, for all of its challenges and problems, demonstrates very clearly that almost any enterprise and almost any sector of almost any size and complexity can be owned and governed by its worker members. These are enterprises where the workers make the ultimate decisions and where they share the profits among themselves. That's inspiring enough.
For Making Contact, I'm Tom Allen in Mondragon, in the Basque Country, Spain.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Rainbow Grocery Cooperative for partially funding this show. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.